Right. It's July 3rd, 1997. We're here on Hilo, Hawaii with Jim Kelly. And we're going to talk about his service with IVS in Vietnam, beginning approximately 1959 and stretching till 1964. Jim, we always ask these kind of battery of background questions. Okay. When they get personal, too personal, just say, no, I won't answer that. And by the way, you are free not to answer anything. Why we don't ask those kind of questions. But when were you born?
1936.
And the birth date was?
August 7th.
August 7th. And where were you born?
In Iowa.
And in what town?
Oh, in Wapello.
In Wapello. How do you spell that?
W-A-P-E-L-L-O.
And were you raised on a farm?
Raised in a small town, uh-huh. Although we had a farm.
Right. Uh-huh. But you lived in the...
We lived in a little town.
Yeah. Yeah. And your father was...
Was
a farmer. And
yeah.
Your mom?
A housewife.
A housewife. Yeah. So she wasn't a school teacher on the side or anything.
No.
What was that like growing up in a...
It was all right. Of course, in those days, no one had that much contact with the outside world. When I was in high school, I went on a trip to California. But aside from that, several trips to Chicago, which we were in the eastern part of Iowa, so that wasn't too far away. And when we sent cattle to Chicago stockyards in those days, I used to sometimes go with the truck. But aside from that, not much traveling was involved.
What was the religious orientation of your family?
My family... generally, especially in my grandmother, was active in the Methodist Church at the time, and I grew up in the Methodist Church from little child in Sunday school, going with my grandmother, and all the way through until college, yeah, and was fairly active in youth groups and things like that. Yeah. I was an usher for a while. And then there was a short period of time when after I graduated from college, from Iowa State University, until I went to Vietnam with IBS, when I was back home for about a year after college. And during that time, too, I got involved in the church. It was the most, in a small town like that.
Mm-hmm.
The,
but your parents
the most
weren't?
Anxious. Weren't My parents very, never attended, no.
So other than, why did you go to California? What was the trip?
Oh, it was a Boy Scout jamboree, yeah.
And so that's interesting, though, because in small ways, Chicago and California, it is the rest of the world.
Yeah.
There are portals out there, even for a boy from Eastern Iowa. Did you, did you went to high school in Iowa? And why did you choose Iowa State?
Agriculture.
And had you always wanted to do agriculture?
No, not until my senior year in high school.
Uh-huh.
I took a course in agriculture. They offered one for the first time. Uh-huh. Including the FFA, the Future Farmers of America, and so forth.
Uh-huh.
They started in my senior year. And at the time I graduated, I couldn't think of anything else I was interested in.
So you hadn't been active in 4-H or anything like that before?
No, I hadn't. Uh-huh. And Iowa State was the agricultural school at the time. So that's how I ended up there.
So what was your first impression of the big university, the state university?
It was very favorable. Mm-hmm. One of the things I can remember is the campus. The campus is beautiful. And I had been to the University of Iowa before because it was close. We used to go up there for basketball games and football games and things. But it doesn't have much of a campus to it. Iowa State was beautiful. And I can still remember the buildings, the grassy areas, the knolls, and things like that. I think that was what made the immediate impression on me.
Was there any, did you have any international exposure when you were there?
No.
Just straight American agriculture?
Yes. I recall very little in the way of agriculture, or foreign agriculture. Very little in the way of geography. And since I'm a professor of geography now, I noticed that how much I would have profited by that in agriculture, of knowing where are the major agricultural regions of the world, what they produce, what problems they have, and so forth. That would have been, as I look at what I teach now, which in one of the courses I teach is geography of agriculture. I think back when I first went to Vietnam, if only I had had this course, how much better I would have been as an IVS volunteer. Mm-hmm.
So when you got your BA in agriculture.
BS in agriculture.
BS in agriculture. Right. Had you heard about IVS before you graduated?
Yes. Uh-huh. My senior year, the Career Center in the agriculture division at the time, College of Agriculture, had posted a notice on the board. Mm-hmm. That this organization was looking for people to send overseas. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I wanted to go overseas. Mm-hmm. I really don't know why. Mm-hmm. I guess I wanted to get away. I wanted to do something different, wanted to see other places. But they posted the notice, I wrote to them. Mm-hmm. IVS was very small at the time. Mm-hmm. Very, very frugal. Knopfzinger. John Knopfzinger was head of it. To give you an idea, I'd never met him. I never did meet him. I wrote to them. They finally ended up hiring me and everything and sent me over to Vietnam without an interview, without any contact with the Washington office except by letter. No uh-huh. telephone calls, no nothing. They originally were going to send me to Laos, as I recall, and then for some reason, at the last minute, they sent me to Vietnam as an animal husbandry advisor, animal science advisor.
So you weren't married then at all?
No,
you were still
no,
single. Did your draft eligibility ever enter into the decision?
No, yeah. No.
Just never thought about it?
Yeah. I can't remember for sure the situation at the time, but I know the draft was not as active then, as I recall, as it was in a few years
mm-hmm.
later.
Yeah. Well, you'll be happy.
Yeah, at the time when I went, all of us, we were all men, all agriculturalists, all single, except for Gordon Brockmuller, who was the chief of party when I first went there, mm-hmm. Who was married, his wife was there. And then he left during my tour, and Don Luce took over mm-hmm. after that.
So, of course, this wasn't unusual. If you had a BA in agriculture, or BS in agricultural science, that was all the criteria really that you needed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And so they sent you a plane ticket?
They sent me a plane ticket.
You flew probably...
My passport.
Flew via Alaska?
No, we went through Hawaii.
Hawaii?
There was some Japan Airlines. Yeah. We came to Hawaii, stayed overnight, maybe a day, went mm-hmm. overnight. Then to Tokyo a couple of days. Then to Hong Kong, a couple of days, then to Saigon. It was a long trip. Jets were out. Pan Am had jets, mm-hmm. but I think they were about the only airline going across the Pacific with jets.
Oh, and a Stratocruiser?
So it was a DC-7.
A DC-7?
Yeah. Oh. I can't remember how long it took, mm-hmm. but it takes, I think, 7 hours now by jet. So it must have been 10 or 12 hours by propeller airplane. Anyway, from Honolulu to Tokyo.
Yes, right.
And almost as far to, mm-hmm. to Hong Kong from Tokyo. Yeah, so it was a long, long trip.
So you flew to Hong Kong and from Hong Kong to Saigon.
Yeah.
What was your, when the hatch opened in Saigon, when did you arrive?
October, mm-hmm. sometime in October 1959. My first impression was, well, we landed and it was rainy. It was afternoon. Mm-hmm. October. Yeah, rainy season would still be on then. It was very hot. I remember that even with the rain. First impression was fairly good. Of course, I was excited to see everything. I do remember as we walked into the waiting area, we had to wait a long time for the bags to be brought in, maybe because of the rain and such. But I was sitting there and there was an American lady sitting next to me coming back from somewhere, but who had been in Saigon for some time. Her husband was a military advisor there, and we started talking, and she was full of complaints about Vietnam, the Vietnamese, and everything, which I didn't pay much attention to. Mm-hmm. It was obvious that she didn't care for it, mm-hmm. and was exaggerating the conditions. Don Luce and Burl Lanier met me at the airport. They had a jeep outside one of the IBS Jeeps, got our bags, got in the Jeep, drove to the IBS house, which wasn't far away from the airport at that time, at the livestock station in Tanzania. I remember we went inside the IBS house at that time, and one of the first things I noted was the geckos, the lizards, on the walls and the ceilings. Of course, I got very used to those after a while, but I can still recall that. I recall the mosquito nets on the beds. We had kind of a small dormitory at the time. All the beds were in one room then. It was a very good introduction, I think. I think Don and Verl were two very good people to introduce me to Vietnam. Verl had been in Japan on an exchange, 4-H exchange program before he had gone to Vietnam. Don Luce had been there in Vietnam for almost 2 years by then. And so there was a holiday coming up. Must have been a Vietnamese holiday or something. I can't remember what. And so we had gone downtown, I think, and then we had gone out to Vung Tau for the weekend, the three of us, to go to the beach. And we stayed at a hotel out there. Actually, interestingly, we got out there and there were no hotel rooms, but they rigged us up a bed out on the porch of the place. So that's where we're at. So we stayed there for a couple, overnight. So we did that. Came back in. And then several of the IBS people came in that weekend, I remember. Bob Plummer, Bob Falaska came down from Balak, and some others. And so I had the chance to meet all of them. And I remember we went out. We went down, there was a parade or something going on for the holiday. We watched that downtown. We went to Tuzon Street, Continent Street, which was the old French street downtown, main part of town. Very, very pretty in those days. I understand it's changed a lot since then.
It's still nice. The design was nice.
Yes. But they, at that time, they still had trees, and somebody told me they cut the trees down. And it was very, very, very nice. And so we walked around. Can't remember where we went to a sidewalk cafe, but there was one sidewalk cafe we used to frequent a lot down there. Went there. It was very nice. It was nice having this group of IVS people again. I think that in many respects, that really made it tolerable, in a sense, and made getting used to it a lot easier. Several years after that, I went to Taiwan to work for a year on something somewhat similar, although not involved so much in agriculture. And I was by myself. And there was a group of people, but all Chinese. And I oftentimes compared the experience of both of those and how different it was having the IBS group in Vietnam. Because in those days, I think people have to remember 1959, 1960, 61, very few people went overseas. And it was not until really the mid-60s that the Peace Corps got started in earnest after that. And in those days, about the only people I had ever met or heard of who had been overseas working was missionaries. And of course, IVS had a very strong background. Many of the people who were on the board of directors of IVS had been former missionaries, so they had that experience. But people simply weren't traveling much in those days. You know, we did not have the world economy that we have now, and so we did not have many people who were going overseas for business in those days. The American military was sending advisors to different places, so you had a few of those people. But other than that, civilian people overseas were rather rare. And for that reason, when we traveled around in Vietnam and when we went on vacation to Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, places, you had a reason to talk to Americans that you met because you were so rare. To see other people. When I arrived in Vietnam, as I recall, there were 3,000 Americans in the country. Most of those American military advisors. And of the military advisors, virtually all of them were officers. And very, very few enlisted men. I think I met probably less than half a dozen enlisted men during the first 2 years I was there. The procedure at that time was for everybody to get a tour of the IBS stations. Don Luce told me that when he first went there, all of the IBS team was in Ban Mae Thuot. I think at near one of the Mountain Yard villages. I don't think it was Buoni now, but I can't remember. But anyway, outside of
it was outside of town.
Yeah. And they all lived there in a single place. And it was not long after that that both the IBS people and what we then called USOM, United States Operation Mission, which was the what form later was called AID, USAID. The USOM people, I think Howard Harper, who was the IBS liaison at the time, and Gordon and others got together and decided this is not the way IBS ought to go, and wanted to put IBS people on a group of experiment stations, agricultural experiment stations that the government of Vietnam was establishing at the time, with American help, of course. And so that's what they did. And by the time I arrived, they were already on these agricultural stations. So it was the egg station at Ban Mae Thuot, the egg station at what was called Nha Ho, but was near Phan Rang, egg station at Da Lat, egg station and agricultural school at Bao Lac, or Blau, time, one at Hung Lac, which was outside Bien Hoa, near Saigon, and a new station at Madrak, which was halfway between Ban Mae Thuot and Nha Trang, out in an isolated area, and then
where
a new
Ban
station.
Lock?
Ban Lac?
Yeah, you said Ban Lac?
No, Madrak.
Oh, okay, Madrak. But and, so could you go through the stations again?
Yeah, Ban Mae Thuot.
Ban Mae Thuot.
So up in the highlands area. Madrak was also in the highlands area. Nha Trang was, not Nha Trang, Phan Rang was very near the coast.
Right.
Da Lat, up in the mountains. Bao Lac was also kind of in the mountains. It was on the road between Da Lat and Saigon.
Okay.
Yeah. Then Hung Lac was sort of outside of Bien Hoa, on the road from Saigon to Da Lat. You go through Bien Hoa and then Hung Lac sometime after that. And then also they were beginning a station at My Tho in the south
okay.
of Saigon, in the Delta area. That was our only station in the Delta. And Vuor Linh Ier was going down there. So they took me on a tour of stations. We drove from Saigon up to Ban Mae Thuot. At that time, it was safe to drive everywhere during the day, and almost everywhere at night. The only places that we avoided at night, or people avoided at night, was in the Mekong Delta area. But daytime, it was okay. So we drove up to Ban Mae Thuot, and part of it at night by Land Rover. I went with Bob Falaska and Bob Plummer, I think, So we went up and stayed at the station at Ban Mae Thuot overnight, maybe a couple of days or so. Then we drove down to Madrak, and Burr Fruchi was at Madrak. He's just recently gone there. It was a livestock station. And Burr, I think Gordon Brockmuller was with us by then. Burr asked if I could go there to join him at Madrak. And so I remember Brockmuller said, well, let's see, we'll wait and see. So we drove around, went through all the stations back down to Saigon, and they decided they'll send me to Phan Rang. They had another person who had gone a month earlier than me, that they were going to send with Burr to Madrak. It's already planned. So they sent me to Phan Rang. What we did in those days...
Was that Bob Hargraves?
No.
That went
it
with,
was Clevenger.
Oh.
Cowles Clevenger was his name. Yeah. what they were doing in those days is that they, IBS volunteers spent the first month not doing anything except trying to learn the language and learning the country, but not really doing much actual work at all. So they sent me the Fon Rong to do that. We had no language book or anything like that. We made use of the IVS interpreters who were stationed there, one at each station usually. And so I did that. We were about halfway through it, and somebody came around, maybe it was Don Luce, I'm not sure, visiting, and found out the IVS interpreter wasn't doing much of anything about teaching me Vietnamese. And I was pretty much lost as to direction to go. And they had been having problems with Kaus Clevenger there because he hated the place. So they decided they'll move him to Ban My Thuot and send me up to the Drac with Bert Fucci. And had a very good interpreter at the time, Wu Zhou Chi, who now lives near Washington, D.C.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
You may have met him.
Spell the name for the...
Bui, B-U-I, Zung, Z-U-N-G, I think, G-C-H-I. Yeah. So he began teaching me Vietnamese. I stayed there with Bert a couple of months, I think. Then Bert went on vacation, came back, and they sent Bert somewhere else. I think to Ban My Thuot, yeah, I believe. And that left me at Madras by myself, which at the time was okay. It got lonely later on, but at the beginning it was okay. And then after that, they moved me down to Hung Lock near Saigon at the livestock station. That must have been... late 1961, I think, by then. And there were a group of, this is a big station, and since it was near Saigon, it was more active than the others, simply because it was near the government in Saigon. Bob Plummer was there, Clyde Eastman was there, I was there, Floyd Burrell was there. Later on, after Floyd left, I think Tom Cooper came. So I think normally there were about four of us at that station. I was the livestock person, and the other three, as I recall, were the crops people. So we had kind of our own little fraternity there. Shared a house, half of a house with the livestock manager and so forth. We were closer to Saigon, so going into Saigon for a weekend was not unusual for us. It was during that time that we begin to see the changes in Vietnam and in the American presence in Vietnam. For me, the war began in 1960, March of 1960. We had heard of a very large battle, battalion-sized battle, between the Viet Cong and the Vietnamese military, not located near us, located in that border area near Cambodia there. But that was the first major event that occurred. The things that were occurring prior to that were all pretty much terrorist activities. The taking over a village, killing the village chief, ambushes along the highway, but virtually all in the Mekong Delta area. And for the IVS people at the time, the growing terrorism and war really impacted us mostly as to where we could go. Of all the stations at the time, I don't recall that we started losing stations then because of the war. We were all in pretty safe areas, but it was where we could travel. And the first thing that happened, as I remember, is that road from Saigon to Ban My Thuot that kind of skirted Cambodia. In fact, there was a point along that road called Three Frontiers, and it marked, that was an old French boundary line. I think it marked the boundary Vietnam, Cochin, China, Annam, and Cambodia there. But anyway, there was a little marker. Mm-hmm. I remember we used to stop there, take pictures at 322. That road closed. It's got to be too dangerous to go on. What usually happened first is that roads became dangerous at night. So we stopped traveling at night on certain roads, but daytime was okay. And then finally, if it got worse, then they were closed day and night. But usually it was travel at night that was the problem first. But surprisingly, up until I left Madrak, certainly, I drove all the way from Saigon to Dalat, around to Nha Trang, up the mountain to the highlands, to Bamitut, to Madrak and Bamitut at night sometimes, because it was cooler at night, mm-hmm. and it was okay.
What did you think, of course, because you didn't go to Harper's Ferry or these other things that everyone did later, yeah. you just went straight out to Vietnam.
Right.
What did you think you were doing in terms of, why were you, what was IVS doing in Vietnam? Mm-hmm. What was its connection with USAID? At the time, mm-hmm. as you perceived it,
yeah.
rather than a little bit later. And what was this war kind of creeping up? What was that all about? Do mm-hmm. you remember even thinking
yeah.
about it?
I mean, oh, yes, yeah. yes, all the time. When I first went over, for me, IVS was involved in foreign advising, of being advisors, and in my case, an agricultural advisor, mm-hmm. to advise people in foreign countries how to improve agriculture. How to develop agriculture. And that word development was very common at the time. Agricultural development. And that's what, I think that's what all of us had gone there to do, mm-hmm. Aside from the adventure part mm-hmm. of it and all of that. That was pretty much the image that I got after I arrived, that we were very definitely advisors. Although it was a bit difficult to decide how we would fit in, because arriving in Vietnam, there was an American group of advisors in place, not IVS people, mm-hmm. but what the USOM people, USOM mm-hmm. people, later AID people, who were older agriculturalists, who were the advisors to the Vietnamese government. Mm-hmm. So then you had a situation of where does IVS quite fit in to all of this. Actually, I think it worked out fairly well. We considered ourselves the field people. We were the ones who lived out in the countryside. The USOM advisors lived in Saigon. They were all older. They were all had liaisons with the Vietnamese government. We had liaisons, or our contact was with the station managers out in the countryside, in the field. So I think it worked out fairly well. I think for the USOM people, USOM ag people, we were all young kids. And I think, you know, considered us very young, and therefore not knowing very much what to do. Yeah, they were right, since we were very young. The IVS people considered the USOM people to be stuck in Saigon. That was our biggest criticism. You know, they don't know Vietnam. They don't know the countryside. We do because we live here. They don't know Vietnamese, and we do because we live there. So a little bit of truth, a little bit of exaggeration involved.
Yeah. Did you... You know, simply because of who you are and mm-hmm. and how this has just kind of popped up, this idea of development.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever, for example, if you went to an area in which people had no cash crops but wanted a cash crop,
mm-hmm.
you might introduce grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any perception that the Vietnamese needed your assistance?
At the time, no. No, I didn't consider that mm-hmm. at the time. Because I just took a look around
mm-hmm.
and saw, you know, for what was for me extreme poverty and very, what I considered underdeveloped agriculture. One of the things I have to remember is that at the time, almost all of the agricultural stations were located north of Saigon, not in the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
There was one station in lowland areas, but if you go over that list, which I didn't realize at the time, mm-hmm. but geographer now, mm-hmm. I know, you can recognize it. The only station that was in the lowland areas was at Phan Rang. And Phan Rang is an extremely dry area. It's a very odd place in mm-hmm. Vietnam. Not quite desert, but getting close. You could see cactus growing mm-hmm. in the area. So the places where the agricultural experiment stations ended up being were those places that both the government of Vietnam and American Aid wanted to develop new places. They were almost frontier areas. Mm-hmm. In other words, being up in the highlands, mm-hmm. mountain yard places. And we took Madrak, Bao Lac, Da Lac, mm-hmm. Hung Lac, no. But still, Hung Lac was kind of on the edge of the highland areas. So I really didn't see the well-developed agriculture that I would have saw, of course, traveling through it, I did a little bit, but even then, not so much, the well-developed rice growing that you would see in the lowland areas along the coast, and especially in the Mekong Delta. And therefore, I think my image of Vietnam agriculture was not a very accurate one in the beginning, perhaps. Because what had happened was, of course, that when the country was divided into a communist north and a non-communist south. Refugees, mostly Catholic refugees, came down from the north by millions. And many of them were resettled in the highland areas or in some of these areas that were not well developed. Obviously,